Something happening here. But what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I've got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. 1,000 people in the street, singing songs and a carrying sign. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.
Hey, I heard Sling Blade. White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance radio calling right here in the Midwest, the northern part of the continent, in the middle, west of Ohio and east of Illinois, north of Kentucky and south of Michigan. Yeah, right here. Hey, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581, as usual. And thank you for getting your donations in for the radio show. And I mentioned yesterday, I think one person who did not send their email address in with their donation. And when you do that, I'm confused as my bookkeeper. I cannot figure things like that out. So make sure you put your email address in when you go by PayPal or through the mail or however you send it to me, okay? Well, let's see here. It's Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. October 1st. Oh, boy. That temperature is starting to drop a little. It was down about 52 yesterday and I think the day before. And the leaves are starting to tell me that they're getting ready for the big drop. We've got some beautiful trees in the fall around here. Of course, they're beautiful all year long, but especially in the fall. I've got one beside my house out here that turns just a brilliant red leaves, and I'll try to send you a picture of that. So anyhow, it's the time we used to go down to Brown County here in Indiana, where they had the Shades Park down there, I believe, and they say it's one of the most beautiful sights you want to see in the fall. Yeah, that's something I like about being back here in the Midwest. We have the seasons. We don't always appreciate the seasons, especially in a deep winter. But when it comes spring, we really appreciate the spring and the summer and the fall. So it's worthwhile taking a little bitter with the sweet. Yeah. Well, I started to put up my big mast on the roof the other day, and I got it up about 10 or 12 feet, and it telescopes, and I decided that particular telescoping pipe was caca. So I'm going to pull one down off my big tower out here and redo it and get that thing way up about 40 feet above the roof, boy, and then I'll be able to talk to everybody. I think I sent this along to you yesterday, but I'm going to do it again. TT, I happen to like the way Michael Shurer and his conclusions about the Middle East and Israel. However, Shurer states his conclusion, drop Israel, that's good, and drill on your own land to drop the Saudis for a source of oil. That's the conundrum about drilling and being energy dependent. If we do this, we will harm our environment a lot more if we would drill and frack ourselves to independence. I suppose there's no chance of convincing 3 billion to ride motorized scooters to save the earth. One hand, fight for Israel and die. Other hand, drill and die and frack and die. Random thoughts from the lone wolf. And then he sent me an addendum to that. The other alternative is to live closer in localized communities, perhaps something similar to intentional communities where everything is within walking distance and no cars or motorized vehicles are needed except for bicycles, maybe, after the races are separated, of course. Okay. That's true. I'll tell you, you know, but they used to be that way in the cities, too. There was complete neighborhoods everywhere where they were self-contained. Plus, you could get on a bus or a tram or something, streetcar, and ride to work. But you had grocery stores, and you had hardwares, you had all that stuff in the cities. But in the country, that's fine, too. Small towns, such as the town I live near, it's about 3 miles to town. You can walk that much and be good for me to do it. And most of the town is accessible by walking or bicycling or motor scootering. However, you know how the big box stores now, they go outside of town and buy cheaper land and build their big damn department stores. Hopefully in time the departments, these big Walmart outfits will go down the tube. However, here in this little town, we do have Kmart's and some of the big hardwares and so forth that are close in to where you can walk to. And you can, if you're a senior and you get too much out of shape, you can rent an apartment pretty reasonably. I mean, there is no such thing really as a reasonable apartment or house, but you can rent in town where you don't have to have a car or anything else. So if you design your life around what you know is happening and will happen more in the future, it's not that bad. And the other thing is, don't go in debt. Don't use a credit card to owe money. If you're going to use a credit card, you use a credit card to make money. The Chinese learned that a long time ago, and I've told you this before, where you can, if you have a small group of friends, you can take your credit cards, and you can pool your credit if you trust the people really well, in which that's another problem. Who can you trust? And you can buy something, you know, at an auction or something that you know is a really good price, and you can resell it within 30, maybe 60 days, and it doesn't cost you hardly anything for borrowing that money on the card. And you split the profit, or do it individually, which I've done several times. You can go to an auction, buy a car, get a real good deal, turn it over in 30 days, and it doesn't cost you anything. Somebody just interrupted my producing here with an ad that they'll give you a free security system. Well, of course, you know how that is. They give you the free security system, then they tie you in for a contract, get you into a lot of credit, and then you're stuck with it and then paying a high rental fee. So don't fall victim to that kind of stuff. These salespeople do that all the time. They're always going to give you something free, but believe me, at the other end, there's a payoff. So anyhow, if you don't have to have a Rolls Royce to drive around in, or maybe not even a car, and if you shop, buy used stuff, go to the thrift shops, go to the auctions, and in the summertime here in the Midwest, there's a million garage sales, and the farmers are selling right off the farm, and we have the sales of vegetables and so forth on the city square right downtown all summer. So you can live real cheap. People whining about, I can't make it. Well, that's because they're on credit. They're buying cars on time. They're buying everything on time. Of course they can't survive, you know. So don't forget it. You can survive. A country boy can survive. And above all, don't try to keep up with the niggers and the Jews. they're buying big houses now, too, you know, along with the idle rich and the dumbass ne'er-do-well white working class that once they get a few bucks, they buy a great big box house and are stuck with the payments. So don't try to keep up with it. It used to be keeping up with the Joneses. Now it's keeping up with the niggers and the Saudi Arabians and the Indians. And and if you're married, if you got a husband or a wife who wants to get in debt all the time, either get them in line or leave them. And as far as children are concerned, right now, if you live the way most of these dumbasses live, it's going to cost you about $250,000 to raise a kid to 18. Yeah, that's $250,000 to raise a kid to 18. And then you want to put out another $20,000-$30,000 to send them to a no-good Jew-think university? I think not. Boy, I'll tell you. That Thoreau documentary, they've run it for years, and it just keeps running and running and running and running. So now they've got this Mose Asumong, this black gal from Germany that I mistakenly did a documentary, an interview with her, and they just keep running this thing. You know, the Germans are really fascinated with, well, not anymore, I guess, than Americans. She's a novelty nigger, octoroon. And she went around and interviewed a bunch of the right wing. Did she come to me? Which I told her to keep me separate from the right wing and the KKK. But yet, in the articles about her, they keep linking me to the right wing, which is total BS. But anyhow, it's my fault. Not going to do any more documentaries unless I do them myself. Because they always want to put me in bed with all these other people that I don't agree with. And then when they put it together and put it out on the web, it sounds like I'm endorsing them. Which I only endorse me. I'm only able to endorse me. I can't endorse other people. They're on their own. One sentence out of this news article about this octoroon German that they're so proud of says, a few friends have told me that the film is different, was cool, and later I saw their website and a few video clips on YouTube. The interview with Tom Metzger was ridiculous. Some things he said were just horrible, like the possibility of a race war. My roommate has heard the clip, and she was totally confused. I cannot believe that people could be proud of these ideas. But I really like what Mo says when she hugs a tree. You see what just a few generations can do with the media and the churches on people's asses? They could turn proud Aryans into second-class niggers. No matter how blue their eyes are, no matter how white their skin is or what, they're turned into nigger thinkers. For all intents and purposes, they might as well be niggers. They're no good to us anymore. Anyhow, that documentary is going to go around the world 100 more, maybe 500 more times. Here's a little bit more from this article. Though I could not see the film, I enjoyed an opportunity that I could get to know them. At lunch, I learned a lot about Mo's career and life. We have discussed a lot about race and ethnicity. I found it interesting that she believes there should ever be a race. She wanted to know why Americans still be divided in race if there's only one humanity. In my opinion, it is unfortunate that there are structural racism in the United States. But for this reason, we must not ignore the race. I think we need social injustice only confirmed that we could improve it. Nevertheless, Mo was a very interesting experience and perspective with race. It was really great to meet this director. Hopefully, I can see the movie in the future. Well, it might pay for you if you see it if you're white, but I don't think it'll make any difference with you. I might ask these people, if racism's terrible, racial separation's terrible, what do you think Europe would be like if it was totally niggerized, which it's becoming, in England too, and the United States? What would you imagine society would be like? Would it be, like now? Well, no, it would be 100 times worse than now. Nobody seems to ask these people that question. Can you honestly say that you would think that Europe would be can you imagine a nigger Switzerland? Can you imagine an all nigger Nordic countries? I know there is getting that way, but not yet. So no so-called liberal can answer you without lying if he answers, it'd be wonderful, be the same. Yeah, still be inventing things and electronics and cell phones and fancy cars and all that. Sure. Sorry, boys, it wouldn't be like that. Let's listen here to a bit about what's a banana republic. Are we becoming a banana republic? Let's see whether you agree with this one.
You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
So what is a banana republic? Aside from the store at the mall. Man, the joke is just not working. Anyway, that's Matt behind the camera. I'm Ben. That makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. We've done a series on the legendary father of public relations, Edward Bernays, and in the second episode of that series, we look at the way he used his propaganda skills to drum up American support for the invasion of Guatemala in 1954. Now, this was an instance wherein a large company and the government worked together toward a common goal, which was, of course, to overthrow the democratically elected Jacob Arbenz Guzman, because he wasn't playing ball with the corporate interests that UFC represented and controlled. Now, at the time, it's safe to say that Guatemala was indeed a banana republic. The UFC owned more than 40% of the arable land. They controlled the post office. They controlled the railroad. And, of course, they controlled the banana trade. Clearly, bananas are still available worldwide, and we have a different video for a different show called Stuff from the Future. It's about the future of bananas, but check it out later when you get a chance. The point here is that most people nowadays don't really know what a banana republic means, how it's defined. So let's take a closer look at this with a little help from Josh Clark. The first question, what is a banana republic? Well, it's got a couple of definitions. One, a banana republic is tiny. Now, Guatemala is comparatively small, right? So it qualifies there. Two, a banana republic is despotic. Guatemala certainly qualified at that time. Three, a banana republic has an economy that centers on one or maybe two agricultural exports, such as bananas or coffee, which we didn't have in the budget this time around. But take our word for it. Now, what's interesting here is that it leads to one of the big, big questions that a lot of people were asking recently, and that is the United States becoming a banana republic? In fact, that's the title of Josh's blog on the subject. And what he finds here is really interesting. It turns out that since banana republic nowadays is a pejorative, a kind of insult, that people will tend to make up or add meanings to the term banana republic and then use it as an attack word. And it's very easy to use whatever term you want when you can make up the definition, right? So what we get when we look at this is that the banana republics, which the term, some experts believe the term originates in O. Henry's Book of Cabbages and Kings, and that's a very old book. But now we see the term used when it's convenient politically to do so. And when we ask the question whether or not the United States is becoming a banana republic, most of the people who do believe that's the case would cite the rise in income inequality. And it's true that there is a rise in income inequality in the United States. But does that make the United States a banana republic? Unfortunately, for the people who want to use the term, this is not the case. So thanks so much for watching, guys. If you want to learn more about Edward Bernays...
Well, when I use the term banana republic, it's a pejorative word for the various races coming in here, the blacks, the Mexicans, and the Guatemalans. To me, that's the banana republic, and that's pretty accurate as far as I'm concerned. A racial hodgepodge, a garbage can. You might find that this is interesting. Chinese volunteers are now arriving to defend Donbass People's Republics, according to sources in the units of the armed forces of the Novorossiya, NAF, volunteers from the Chinese People's Republic are arriving to help defend Donbass. Pictured is an ex-People's Liberation Army soldier and civil professional who took up arms for the defense of the Donetsk Basin from Nazi forces from the Kiev Junta. Now, we're not sure whether these are real National Socialists over there. I don't think they are. Or Nazis. There's two types, Nazis and then there's Nazis, so we have to figure out who's who. The first volunteers have already arrived at the location of the militia units in Donetsk. The new batch of Chinese anti-fascists are expected to arrive soon in the Donbass. At the moment, the militia considers the possibility of deploying a Chinese brigade in one of the units NAF. Isn't that interesting? Well, guess what? I just heard that the folks over at VNN won't talk to a friend of mine or an associate of mine who has his own show because he talks to me and had me on his show. Oh, sour grapes, VNN. Well, I couldn't do anything as bad as you guys did with furnishing aid and comfort to that moron who went and tried to shoot up the Jews and shot some Catholics, Mr. Miller. I told you about him. I told you, but I guess you still support him. Well, anyhow, I don't like to talk about other people's, especially when they're in the right wing. It's a waste of time. Now, here's a sad story about a right winger. I think I've said something about this before. A former member of the Ku Klux Klan pleaded guilty Tuesday for his role in a cross burning outside an interracial family's house in Minor Hill in April 2012, according to a press release by the U.S. Department of Justice under Eric Holder. Yeah, they like to make big deals out of that. See, these guys could get involved in some Klan signed him up at a gas station, probably, and then they get excited about doing something. We're going to show those niggas, and they burn a 2 or 3 foot cross outside their house, and suddenly they're in the hoosegow, and immediately they resign from the Klan. They probably are only in the Klan about 6 months, if at all. This is what we got to deal with, this right-wing craziness. Timothy Flanagan, 33, now he's old enough to know better. You know, what's he? How's that hurting a black interracial family? I don't understand. If I was in an interracial family, somebody burned a 3-foot cross on the front of my yard, I just go out and kick it down and stomp it out and laugh my ass off and go back in the house and have a beer. Well, anyhow, he pleaded guilty in a federal court in Nashville to one count of conspiring with others. See, they get you with that conspiracy all the time. You know, how many guys does it take to erect a 3-foot cross and set it on fire? Well, we had to have the whole clever down there. Anyhow, others to threaten, intimidate, and interfere with an African-American man's enjoyment of his housing rights and his screwing of a white woman. And one count of interfering with those housing rights according to the release. Well, I told you there's no such thing as a right anyhow, but anyhow, they still use it. It's archaic, really. So anyhow, you interfered with that nigger's ability to have sex with that white woman, man. The release stated that Flanagan is a former member of the Church of the National Knights of the Ku Klux Klan affiliate. Wow. Flanagan's alleged co-conspirators, Timothy Stafford, 41, of Minor Hill, and Ivan Rusty London, the 4th, 21, of Lexington, Kentucky, previously pleaded guilty for their roles and currently await sentencing, according to the release. You see, something like this, it's just more of a prank than anything else, and it certainly didn't hurt this interracial couple. I mean, you know, these guys conspired, you know, so they had a few beers and did it. The release stated Flanagan faces up to 20 years, God, can you believe it, and fines up to $500,000. That's Eric Holder. It also said Stafford faces up to 10 years in prison and fines up to $250,000, and London faces up to 5 years in prison with fines up to $250,000. Flanagan's sentencing is set for January 8, 2015, according to the release. Can you believe that? Can you believe that? See, that's how insane the right wing is and how insane the people who are prosecuting them is. Instead of just saying, what a bunch of dummies, go home, we're going to give you a ticket for stupid actions. And so took three guys to get drunk and go out and erect a 3-foot flaming cross. And they're looking at one guy looking for 20 years. Now, do you understand what I'm telling you about lone wolf and things like this? Do not change anything except change your mode of living. Your wife leaves you, your kids hate you, the dog bites you. Yeah. Probably you wouldn't have got much more time if you'd have blown the guy's brains out, you know, with a gun. I mean, come on. Meanwhile, the big crooks in the Republican and Democratic War Party continue their stripping the nation of money to buy all the weapons and all that and everything, and they walk around free and drinking cocktails and having a ball sitting by the pool, and the working man is doing himself in. Here's another dim light bulb in the wisdom basket. I knew this guy back a few years ago only by mail, and I think maybe on the telephone a few times. The name's Scott Shepherd. He's a funeral director down in Tennessee, and he's going around now. They have to have a new one every once in a while to go around and tell how horrible the Ku Klux Klan is. He joins this guy on the radio getting in and out of the KKK and reforming his racist beliefs. Well, let me tell you something. This was on the David Pakman show. One thing that encouraged him to change his belief is he became a drunk and he was getting DUIs all over the place. So he decided to reform himself. He'll still be a drunk. Anyhow, I'm going to... Wow.
Former Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan in Tennessee. Scott, I'm so interested in speaking to you, and in researching you today, I came across so many interesting things from your past, and I think an interesting place to start would be kind of your childhood. What you would describe as a racist environment.
Well, yes. The community in the state that I grew up in was the state of Mississippi, which you know was a hotbed of racial turmoil back in the 60s. I was born in 1959 and grew up through those turbulent years. As far as growing up in a racist home, no. I was not taught any type of racism by my parents whatsoever.
And where did you first start to think about or consider the beliefs that ultimately led to your joining the KKK?
I think, of course, first my first introduction to the Ku Klux Klan was probably third or fourth grade in school with the Mississippi history books. They went, through the turbulent years of the 60s and immigration and busing, and they touched on the subject of the Ku Klux Klan. But at that time, they did not go in depth with the Ku Klux Klan and say, you know, the Ku Klux Klan is bad or wrong. They just kind of touched over it. And of course, my research in it, you know, and type frame mind that I was in, you know, as a troubled child, I picked up on the Ku Klux Klan and my perception interpreted it as a hero organization.
So even though the school didn't present the KKK as a kind of heroic or positive organization, something about that made you start looking into the KKK on your own, is that right?
Well, sure. Of course, the school didn't make it out to be a bad thing either. So they just, like I said, they just kind of touched on the subject. And it was they took a neutral stand, and it was not a bad organization or a good organization.
So what did you do on your own? In other words, did you talk to people? What kind of, at the time we didn't have Google, how did you inform yourself about the KKK?
Well, I started reading a lot, I finished reading, of course, the Mississippi history books. And in my part of the country, in the state of Mississippi, it was, just common knowledge that the Klan was there. Because we had the integration problems, the school problems, and the anger was really boiling over into that time. And of course, the Klan was making appearances, and I sought out the Klan due to some news reports that I saw where they were holding a rally in Tupelo, Mississippi, and I traveled to Tupelo and watched this rally. And then after watching this rally, I talked to one of the gentlemen and was later contacted by him. But that was also really kind of set up with some background of my childhood. I was in a situation where I was an unhappy child. I was an unhappy child, wasn't happy with myself. And that pretty much made me a target of the Klan tactics of recruitment.
Well, this is, the you being a target is and based on your childhood is exactly the story that we heard from former neo-Nazi Frank Mink. And I don't know if you know Frank at all. I've had him on the show a couple of times.
Right. I do know Frank only by Facebook. We have corresponded some, but yes, I know Frank, very good man.
And he also was able to elucidate this same kind of vulnerability that he identified in himself and others who kind of fell into the neo-Nazi mentality. When you first had this contact, what were the specific beliefs about whether it's African Americans, whether it's Jews, whatever group, what were the specific beliefs that you held that were reflected by the KKK, or did you kind of go in as a blank slate and simply kind of soak up what they taught you?
Well, I guess I kind of...
All I could say is I was down there at the gas station one day getting a cigarette, drinking a Coke, and the guy come along and said, "You want to join the Klan, man? You want to join David Duke's Klan? We're going places, man." And I said, "Well, I want to go places," so that's what I did. I'm not going to make you suffer with the rest of that. It's the same old bullshit. I had a troubled childhood. Well, I don't know. I think there's lots of people have troubled childhood. What happened to me? I didn't have a troubled childhood. I didn't have a childhood. I had a great childhood. Yeah, born in the 38, and in the 50s, it was terrific. You know, we didn't need a Ku Klux Klan because there wasn't no black people within 100 miles. We didn't need a Ku Klux Klan back then. I mean, you know, there was one black guy that used to wash the windows downtown. We had an old cart and sponges and stuff, and he wheeled that around town and cleaned the windows. But he surely was no threat to anybody. But anyhow, these guys kill me. Now, Scott Shepherd was one of David Duke's recruit. And then he spun off, and he was gone for quite a while. Like I say, he worked in a funeral home. And so now maybe he'll get into, instead of necrophilia, he'll get into negrophilia. But he'll be on the tour. They'll all get him on the tour now, and they'll help him with his problems with the law. Give him some money, and they'll say how wonderful he is, and, you know. Sorry about that clip. I couldn't turn the sound down fast enough because the program I took it off of here, off the internet, didn't have a turn down on the audio. It had a mute, but not a turn down. So if I blasted your ears off, I'm sorry.
We know from the childhood song that old MacDonald had a farm. But E-I-E-I-O, look who's got his farm now. It's groups like American Farmland, Farmland Partners, and BlackRock. These aren't dirt farmers wearing overalls and brogans, but Wall Street hucksters in Armani suits and Gucci loafers. The latest fast buck fad for high roller investment trusts, hedge funds, and venture capital speculators is, quote, farming. Not that these dude ranch dandies are actually plowing and planting. No, no, these are soft hands people, buying up farmlands with billions of rich investors' dollars, then tilling the tax laws and threshing the farmers who do the real cultivation. For example, American Farmland Company, which owns 16 farms, is a combine of the largest real estate empire in New York City, two Florida sugar barons, a wealth management outfit, and the real estate brokerage arm of insurance giant Prudential. None of these nouveau sodbusters has a speck of dirt under their fingernails, but they figured out how to work the land without touching it and still harvest a sweet profit. The founder of this scheme says it's like gold, but better, because there is this cash flow. Cash flow? Yes, farmers are charged rent to till the Wall Streeters' land. Then the financiers get a prime cut of any profits from the crops that the farmers produce. Also, the combine is set up as a real estate investment trust, providing an enormous tax break for the Wall Street plowboys. And, of course, there's the mega pay the moneyed elites will reap when they convert their scheme into securities for sale on the stock exchange. This is Jim Hightower saying, a few rich speculators get richer, farmers are turned into sharecrop laborers, and the farms are switched to high-profit crops that require heavy pesticide dosages and soak up scarce water resources. Other than that, this is one hell of a deal.
I think we're right back where we started from. Once the Civil War was over, well, even before, they had tenant farmers, poor white people working their ass off. And after the Civil War, when the Negroes were free, they weren't free at all because they became tenant farmers like poor whites competing against each other, and they got hardly any of the profits and worked their ass off. And like I said, told you before, when I was a little kid, we went traveling through Georgia back in the 40s. We stopped at a little store along the way, and across the street was a black family still getting water out of an open well. And it was explained to us quite simply their new slavery, which was the company store, the guy that owned all the land that they were tenant farming on, would get them loaded up on things, entice them, buy a refrigerator, new stove, new this, new that. And at the end of the year, when it come time to sell the crops and everything, the farmer, the big landowner, would take it take all their money back. And if they tried to run, if they had any debts, the sheriff was employed like the old slave tracker to track them down, whether they were black or white. I actually saw this happening in the state of Georgia back in the late 40s. Maybe it was the mid 40s. Maybe 46 or 47.
Post office. The U.S. Postal Service, I mean. The corporate hierarchy that runs this enormously popular public institution. Yes, I know that USPS has lost revenue it traditionally got from first-class mail delivery, but I also know that letter carriers and postal workers have offered many excellent ideas for expanding the services that USPS can deliver, thus increasing both revenue and the importance of maintaining these community treasures. Yet, the Postal Board of Governors, which includes corporate interests that would profit by killing the public service, seems intent on, guess what, killing it. The board's only idea is to cut services and shut down hundreds of local post offices. Incredibly, their list of closures include the historic post office in Philadelphia's Old City, the very building where Ben Franklin presided as our country's first Postmaster General, appointed by the Continental Congress in 1775. All across the country, post offices that are invaluable artistic and historic assets are slated to be sold to developers. One is the marvelous 1935 Bronx Post Office, with classical architectural flourishes and 13 museum-worthy murals. "It's not just a post office," says one customer fighting the closure. "It's part of my life." No one feels that way about a FedEx warehouse. Yet, says a USPS spokeswoman dismissively, the four-story building is severely underused. This is Jim Hightower saying, so use it. Put a coffee shop in it, a public internet facility, a library and museum, a one-stop government services center, and, as USPS employees have suggested, a public bank offering basic services to the thousands of neighborhood people ignored by commercial banks. Come on, USPS, show a little creativity and gumption, and remember that service is a key part of your name.
Well, like I told you probably a month ago, they sold off the British Post Office, I believe it was 500-year-old institution, and the big boys got it, broke it up, resold it, made a fortune by privatizing the British Postal Service. Another attack on the public. When you going to get uptight and do something about this, boys? It's time for the pitchforks and torches. Yeah, well, it'll come. Take a while longer. Meanwhile, let's let this imperial country eat its own tail. The government, that is. Well, I keep telling you, the intelligence services of this country are in a mess. They try to come on strong, and they're real pushy, and they got the big badges and the big guns, but in reality, they're a paper tiger, unless you walk right up and stomp on their foot. The pair of recent White House security breaches was shocking enough in terms of the laxity of the Secret Service they exposed. Well, maybe that's good. But re-examined in light of the revelation that a man with an assault rifle shot out a White House window in 2011, and the Secret Service didn't find out that the bullets hit the building until 4 days later. It almost beggars the belief that the recent incidents could ever have been allowed to happen. In the first place, it's hard to believe anyone could sprint across the heavily guarded White House lawn and get inside before being taken down. Yet that's what Army veteran Omar Gonzalez, 42, did. It turned out that he got even further inside than previously known. A day after the Gonzalez foray, another man managed to drive up to a non-public entrance of the White House and refused to leave. The natives are getting restless. Those two incidents pierced any perception that the White House is an impregnable fortress. We're always told that it is protected by the most loyal of government samurai. Well, I'll tell you what. tell you what. Could it be that the Republicans are laxing up the security on the White House on purpose? Well, those Republicans wouldn't do that to Obama, would they? So let's rewind to November 11, 2011. On that night, Oscar Ramiro Ortega Hernandez parked his car on a closed street near the presidential residence, stuck his semi-automatic assault rifle out the window, and fired 8 shots at the White House. At least 7 struck the building, including 1 that broke a window. He was caught, pleaded guilty, and sentenced to 25 years in prison. Well, some people might say they should have given him a medal. Seems like all these mestizos are going wild. He was then all but forgotten, cast off as another in the long list of lone nuts who tried to attack the president. Well, I wouldn't want to trade 25 years of my life for that miserable bastard. That's until the Washington Post reported on a stunning series of failures by the Secret Service surrounding the Ortega Hernandez incident. Yeah. Among the revelations, after the shots ran out, a Secret Service supervisor declared them to be the noise of a car backfiring and ordered agents to stand down. The Secret Service didn't know that the White House had been hit until 4 days afterwards, when a housekeeper spotted a broken window and a chunk of white concrete. A later FBI sweep of the area involved turned up $97,000 in damage. Wow. The walls must be made of gold. Ortega Hernandez got away undetected and was only identified after crashing his car and leaving the gun inside. Police questioned Ortega Hernandez the day after the shooting at a park in Arlington County, Virginia, and let him go because there was no national lookout yet issued for him. He would not be arrested until November 16th, 5 days after he shot at the White House. It was the White House at that time. Now it's the Black House. The Secret Service at the time had no cameras that would let him remotely view the White House perimeter. They could not use the shot spotter gunfire detection system that is used in the Capitol to pinpoint the shots because the nearest sensor was more than a mile away. Apparently, the Secret Service isn't too swift with Twitter either. An eyewitness in a taxi behind Ortega Hernandez posted the following on Twitter as it happened. Editor's note, the original tweet has been taken down, so what follows is a retweet of the original. Driver in front of my cab stopped, fired 5 shots at the White House on Constitution Boulevard. That was the end of the tweet. That was at 8:55 p.m. The agency later got around to finding the witness via the social media site, by which time it had already figured out that the bullets had in fact been fired. It just hadn't found the evidence that they had struck the White House. The discovery turned Ortega Hernandez's fusillade into a presidential assassination attempt in the eyes of the government. Since the review of the 2011 incident, the White House apparently has upgraded its security systems to include perimeter cameras, presumably. Hell, I had perimeter cameras 20 years ago, or almost 20 years, I think. I had them mounted on motors on the roof where I could turn them around and see every place, the whole block around my house. I was way ahead of the White House, man. Presumably better than those in use at businesses and homes, so why did another intruder, Omar Gonzalez, another mestizo, get by this month? He, too, had already been questioned by the police and let go. You imagine if that had been a white racist, a white separatist, these guys? Why, hell, it'd be in the news on and on and on and on and on. There was hardly anything about this stuff in the news. Very little. Unbelievably, he was freed despite carrying a hatchet while strolling the White House perimeter in August. This is a month after the Virginia State Police stopped him for reckless driving and found his car in his car numerous weapons, including a sawed-off shotgun, a map of Washington with the White House circled in red. Jeez. Oh, God. Somehow, none of this tripped the Secret Service radar, although the Virginia State Police said they reported it to the president's protection unit. No wonder Obama's getting white hair and a lot of lines in his face. He's not only got ISIS to worry about, he's got the Mexicans, mestizos, that are after him. There's one even more crucial revelation in the Washington Post, all but buried in the details. President Obama has faced more than three times as many threats as his predecessors, according to people briefed on the Secret Service's threat assessment. Well, I wonder why. I wonder why Obama's had all these threats. I thought racism was done. It was over in this country. We elected a black president. A half-white president. The statistics alone should be a wake-up call, big wake-up call, for the Secret Service needs to up its game, which so far has been very sloppy in its current chart. Wait a minute. Let's go back to the Kennedy assassination, when the Secret Service guys were on a drunken party till 7 a.m. in the morning at Jack Ruby's buddy's bar. Yeah, and they did that in Chicago, and they did it in Tampa, Florida. Three other areas where they had a possible assassination team set up. This isn't just happening. I knew guys that went to Washington. A good friend of mine in the Reagan administration went to Washington to work in their security. And I'd known him for years. And about 3 years he came back and he said he was totally burnt out. He says, I don't want anything to do with those guys. He says, they're incompetent. He says, they're in the bars most of the time. They're not doing their job. He said he quit in disgust. The latest two events triggered an internal Secret Service review, which will now encompass the 2011 failures. After the 2011 shooting, the agency won't have to make too many improvements to surpass the dismal results of its earlier self-evaluation. Congress is getting into the Act II, starting with a September 30th grilling of Secret Service Director Julia Pearson. Yeah, what? I'm not a male chauvinist, but let's face it, in some jobs, I think it might be better to have a guy. However, I've seen some very sharp women that could probably handle it, but this gal, when she was interrogated, didn't sound like she was wrapped too tight. How far the Secret Service goes to improve its vigilance this time around bears watching, especially by the president himself. He's probably afraid to go to bed at night. He's probably sleeping in a closet or down in the Capitol bowling alley and down under the ground. You never know when another Gonzalez may show up, man. They're after your ass. Don't forget, it was the Puerto Ricans, I believe it was, who tried to get Truman. They almost got him. There was about five or six of them. I think they're still in jail or dying in jail. But they got clear into the Congress and let off a few slugs. So you got to watch these Hispanics, man. They're really something to behold. And did you know this little bit of information? This was on AP. Published reports say that President Barack Obama rode an elevator this month with an armed security contractor who had three criminal convictions, a violation of Secret Service security protocols. He was on the elevator with a gun, right with Obama. The latest embarrassment for the Secret Service comes after the agency director, Julia Pearson, took full responsibility for a September 19th breach of the White House. Well, you know, if she was in Russia, or at least Soviet Russia or China, she'd be lined up against the wall and shot. The Washington Examiner and the Washington Post reported that the latest incident took place in an elevator during Obama's September 16th visit to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. Well, how about that? I bet that boy's wearing a bulletproof jock strap by now. I don't know if you've seen that movie. I think it was White House Down. Oh, man, these guys, one man takes on everybody and defeats them and saves the president. This is all nonsense to make you think that there's security. There's no security. If ISIS guy wants to come in the United States, and if he's a pro, he can come in here and get anybody he wants if he's smart. They're not here. Al-Qaeda never got in here. If they did, they didn't do anything. For Christ's sake, there's a million targets. And I've said all along, it's all bullshit. Well, let's see. Here's one more story. You may have heard something about it, but we'll put it out anyhow. Now that all the eyes are on the Ukraine and the potential of bigger war looms, there's never been a more important time to understand what's at stake. As Who, What, Why readers know, the real reasons surrounding a conflict are often buried under the headlines and the rhetoric. So it shouldn't come as any surprise that behind the scenes, oil and natural gas are driving a big piece of the U.S. response to Russian involvement in Ukraine. Oh, I never would have thunk that. How did you figure that out? If you want to understand where the rubber meets the geopolitical road in the Ukraine war, you need to learn about the 1,480-mile South Stream natural gas pipeline. The pipeline is the core of the larger battle being fought over Europe between Moscow and Washington. It may even have been a motivation behind Russia's annexation of Crimea. Why does South Stream matter? It's a $21.6 billion project to connect Russia's gas reserves, the world's largest, to Europe's markets. Europe relies on Russia for about 30% of its natural gas. Any delays in finishing the pipeline, scheduled for completion in 2018, can only help Russia's competitors in the international energy business. And one player gearing up to challenge Russia is the European energy market, is the United States. This year, the United States became the largest producer of natural gas and oil hydrocarbons in the world, surpassing Russia and Saudi Arabia. There's solid evidence that the U.S. is seeking both commercial advantages and political influence by gaining a foothold in Europe's oil and gas markets. The evidence comes in part from the targets the Obama administration has chosen to punish for Russia's annexation of the Crimean Peninsula. All of this raises the question on how much of the confrontation in the Ukraine is about and who gets to sell natural gas and later oil to one of the world's biggest energy consumers, Europe. South Stream owes much of its existence to the 2005-2010 Russia-Ukrainian gas disputes, which left many as 18 European countries cut off from Russian gas. Gazprom, Russia's state-run energy company, proposed South Stream as a way of circumventing Ukraine and ensuring an uninterrupted, diversified flow to Europe. It found a willing partner in Italy's state-controlled oil and gas company, Eni S.p.A., and seven other gas-hungry countries. To try to understand how intrinsic South Stream is to the Russian economy influence over Europe, one only has to look at some of the targets of U.S. sanctions against the Russians or Russian-linked companies. Two of them were directly aimed at slowing down or stopping South Stream pipeline. The first South Stream-related company the U.S. targeted was Stroya Transgaz, which is building the Bulgarian section. Putin ally and billionaire Gennady Timchenko owns it, and he's already on the sanctions list. So Stroya Transgaz had to stop construction or risk exposing another company on the project to the sanctions. The second entity in the sanctions crosshairs was the Crimean company called Chernomorgas. That's a big word. After the Russian annexation, the Crimean parliament voted to take over the company, which belonged to the Ukrainian government. And guess what the company owned? The rights to the exclusive maritime economic zone in the Black Sea. And you thought it was about human rights. That's important because Russia routed the pipeline on a longer path through the Black Sea that cut out the Ukraine. It avoided the Crimean waters, going instead via Turkey's. The European Union attacked South Stream through the non-binding resolution that called for a halt to its construction. EU members stated, don't have to pay attention to the resolution, which was mostly designed to put public pressure on Russia. That's where split among the countries in Europe became evident. Several that will benefit from the pipeline have spoken out in support of the construction or moved ahead with agreements to build it. Italy wants it to proceed, and Austria and Russia signed an agreement to construct a segment in defense of the EU's position that the pipeline may violate anti-competitiveness rules. Germany's Siemens will supply the instrumentation for the pipeline. One country that's trying to avoid getting trampled as the giants fight is Bulgaria. It still has close ties to Russia, but is subject to pressure from the U.S. Both have taken aim at its section of South Stream, which is where the pipeline will come ashore from Russia via the Black Sea. The European Union warned the Bulgarian government that its construction tender broke EU rules, and the U.S. sanctioned the company that won the tender, Stroys Transgaz. That's a poor pronunciation, but it's the best I can do. Bulgaria is arguing to the EU that its position is legally sound and it is economic stability is at risk without South Stream pipeline. Bulgaria has no other secure gas supply, so that the national interest must be protected. Economy and Energy Minister Dragomir Stoyanov said. In the meantime, Bulgaria is hard at work finding a way around the U.S. sanctions. The government may hand the construction job to a subsidiary, Gazprom, that's building the Serbian section. And here's a neat trick. The Bulgarian government approved a $835 million loan from Gazprom to pay for it, secured by future revenues of the pipeline. According to Vladimir Putin, South Stream is just a business venture facing ordinary commercial setbacks that have nothing to do with Ukraine. Washington is interfering, Putin said after a meeting with his Austrian counterpart in June, because the United States wants to supply the gas to Europe. It is an ordinary competitive struggle. In the course of this competition, political tools are being used, he said, in referring to the U.S. sanctions. Undoubtedly, the United States has a massive commercial interest in selling natural gas to Europe, thanks to the abundant supply created by the domestic shale gas boom. The U.S. may be able to export liquefied natural gas to European buyers in the near future. Already, Washington has licensed 7 export facilities. About 30 more are awaiting approval. The first exports could start by the end of the year. But since all the infrastructure to ship liquefied gas is not yet in place, Serbian Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić, a South Stream pipeline proponent, has ridiculed the idea of U.S. exports to Europe in a year or two as fairy tales. Meanwhile, Putin has pointedly said that piped gas will always be cheaper than the liquid form. And Moscow has consistently claimed that Europe's gas bill will rise if it chooses alternates besides Russian natural gas. However, there are more than natural gas at play in Europe's energy future. The Obama administration is negotiating a free trade agreement with Europe that could legalize American oil exports for the first time since 1975. This would bring U.S. exporters in direct competition with Russia, which sells 84% of its oil exports to Europe today. Well, there's more to this, but you get the idea. See, these wars and rumors of wars all boil down to the buck. Every time, there's the front story and then the real story. So all these guys going over there to fight each other in Ukraine, all that kind of stuff. and going to get killed and all the people bombed and burned out of their houses is simply over profits for the big corporations for the energy and oil. And when they say United States in these deals, it's not you and me, the working class. It's the big boys, the ruling class. This is the war of the ruling class, just like the kings and queens, same thing. Yeah, so anyhow, that's about it for today. I've gone a little bit over time here. If you have any other questions on this particular article, if you want to get the rest of it, you can go to whowhatwhy.com. They got a lot of good information. So on this Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day, I'm going to get out of here and go do something else. 14:05. Be back tomorrow. Thursday, right? Yeah, Thursday.